Good evening. Before I introduce tonight's speaker, who tells me that he is much better used to playing the piano in this room than delivering lectures, I would like to take the opportunity to say how sorry we are that the official chairman, Sir Michael Mann, unexpectedly can't be with us tonight. Sir Michael's connection with the school is a long one, and I myself can just remember him as a junior lecturer before he went on to his distinguished career at the bar, which led him ultimately to the Court of Appeal. We would like to say that Sir Michael has also played a central role in reactivating the LSE Law Club. He was a regular attender at its functions while he was president and helped greatly in finding speakers and chairing its very popular activities. So we were particularly glad that he agreed to chair this last of the Law Department's centennial lecturers, and in particular because he was also a patron of the series, and we are extremely sorry that he's not with us and wish him a speedy recovery. Our speaker tonight, Professor Cornish, is also an old friend of mine personally and of the school's. He joined the school as a lecturer in 1962, and while he was here, he published a brilliant book on the jury. After a short detour to somewhere else, which we feel very grudging about, Bill returned to the LSE as Professor of English Law in 1970, and went on to build what I think I could call a twin-track scholarly career in intellectual property law on the one hand, on which he published his leading textbook in 1981. But in 1989, he was able to return to what I believe, on the other hand, is secretly his first love, with a masterly work on legal history, law and society in England. After moving to Cambridge, Bill was the first director of the Centre for European Legal Studies there. I think this varied career pattern is very pertinent to tonight's subject. When in 1959 the LSE organised a lecture series, the title chosen was Law and Opinion in England in the 20th Century. The reference was, of course, to Dicey's celebrated book on law and opinion, which, as some of you will remember, contains an important chapter on judicial legislation, to which I imagine the title of tonight's lecture alludes. And his varied career has enabled Bill to survey the judicial enterprise from a number of different perspectives: criminal law, commercial, historical, comparative. I think I should say, as Polonius might have said, but so far as I can remember, he didn't. Thus, the title fittingly concludes our lectures, and the speaker fits the title as well, Professor Cornish.
Professor Harlow, thank you very much. It's always a pleasure to be back in the school, especially when competing with the Christmas tree. I only wish that Professor Michael Wise could pop out from behind it and present each of you with a present, as he used to do for so many years with such glee. While it's a pleasure always to appear under your chairmanship, may I join with you in expressing sadness that Michael Mann can't be with us this evening. It would have been a great pleasure that he would be here for this final lecture in the law series of the LSE's centenary. I think that series has been a fine one. The lectures have included two very different essays in theory. First of all, Professor Unger's Chorley lecture incited legal scholars to highly critical engagement beyond the range of the merely commentative. Professor Teubner's inaugural lecture reflected subtly on the relations between discourses about law and its social functioning. His case for a distinctly legal discourse, at once synthetic, independent, and in a sense ultimate, will deserve sustained reflection when it's published in the book of the series. Also in strategic vein, Sir Anthony Mason, recently retired as my own country's Chief Justice, defined a strictly limited place for fundamental law under democratic constitutions which do not entrench full-scale bills of rights. And to the same general theme, Sir Stephen Sedley added in this series his own thoughtful cadence. Professor Zander turned attention to the obverse side of judicial functioning by questioning many aspects of Lord Wolfe's report on access to civil justice, thereby raising as a root issue the proper balance of state and professional control over the process. The other lectures used more or less specific areas of law to develop a variety of themes. Those most linked to theoretical issues were, first of all, the inaugural lecture of my successor, Professor Collins, who proposed a re-seeing of contract doctrine, if I may encapsulate it crudely, from the outside in rather than from the inside out, starting, that is, from the conditions imposed by the social market rather than the terms agreed in the sanctified individual bargain. And secondly, Lord Wedderburn's invitation to us to see labour relations and their legal underpinnings from Harold Laski's viewpoint, with its strong emphasis on those psychological default modes of judges, which Laski characterised as law behind the law. Further lectures in this category have included Miss Justice Arden on directors' duties, Andrew Park on the teaching of taxation law during and after the era of my own predecessor, Ash Wheatcroft, and last, though incontrovertibly not least, Her Excellency Judge Higgins talked on a century's devotion to international law scholarship in this institution and the gradual acknowledgement of international law precepts by English judges. My own brief, when I was captured for the series in what can only be described as a Harlow Rawlings pincer movement, was in some way to draw together enough threads from these various tapestries to knot them off with some appropriate close. My two detainees demanded a title before I could know anything more than who the slate of speakers were to be. In a certain desperation, I reached the subject of judicial legislation, which should perhaps have been put in inverted commas because, as you rightly surmised, it is of Austino-Dicean pedigree. I was tempted to it for two reasons, both of which you mentioned in your introduction to this series back in April. Albert Venn Dicey has been used for many purposes by subsequent scholars. Indeed, I think his role as an Aunt Sally must make him the winner of any prize for legal bibliometry. But the school has treated him honourably, notably in that mid-century set of lectures which you mentioned, edited in 1959 by the sociologist Maurice Ginsberg, which took the adapted Dicean title, Law and Opinion in England in the 20th Century. Dicey's own lectures under that title for the 19th century, notorious for their reductive, sibylline periodization and their over-emphatic claims for the influence of Jeremy Bentham's supposed individualism, nonetheless contained a rather perceptive chapter on judicial legislation, and that suggested to me the continuing link needed for this lecture. As a remarkable constitutional lawyer, Dicey would unquestionably have been fascinated, who knows with what animus, by British membership of the European Union. And your second point in introducing the series back in April, I think, was that the impact of community law, so central and controversial to many legal issues today, was likely to be underplayed in the lecture series. I have therefore seen it as my business somehow to repair that omission. So one way and another, my brief turned out a very tall order for one who is neither a public lawyer, a human rights lawyer, nor an EC lawyer, really, but someone who's become that strange beast, an intellectual property lawyer. It's a tall order indeed, and for it my only excuse is that he holds his head highest who can least see where he's going. And in the hope of averting a proud fall, I shall refer to a couple of instances from my special field, in order to issue warnings which may strike you as having a Dicean stamp. I might at this juncture add that because I've just come back from Israel and have not really caught up with last week's news, I am not going to devote this lecture to the interesting condition which now exists between the Lord Chancellor and the judges as revealed in various newspapers. Those who wish now to leave may do so. So to what I want to say about judicial legislation. Both Austin and Dicey wrote of a legal system in which statute as a pervasive general source of law was a new phenomenon, and the techniques for generating, drafting, promulgating, and implementing legislation were still being worked out. It was nonetheless a system which, thanks to the constitutional arrangements of 1689, accepted the doctrine of parliamentary supremacy, a theory which Blackstone had endorsed in pursuing the virtues of limited monarchy, and which Bentham and his positivist followers treated as the foundation of increasingly democratic government. The idea that law could be scientifically presented within structured codes was in large measure also novel. So was the associated notion that courts should be shaped into a proper hierarchy within each jurisdiction, a process which in England and Wales was completed only after Dicey's major works had appeared. As we appreciate today, Austin's jurisprudential thought owed much, though not everything, to Jeremy Bentham. But his natural conservatism gave him a Blackstonian admiration of judicial decision-making as a source of law. Case law precedents he distinguished from the professional and other influences of Judge and Co., such as the practice of conveyances, which he characterized as causes of law rather than sources. Nevertheless, Austin characterized judicial lawmaking as legislation improperly so called. The label may seem a hostage to fortune, but he meant it to indicate that any precedential value of a case arose only consequentially from the process of deciding the particular dispute. It was distinct, therefore, from judicial legislation properly so called, as when judges laid down the Macnaghten rules on criminal insanity or the judges' rules on police questioning as general norms to govern future behavior. In this fastidious way, Austin could distance himself from his ever-radical master Bentham, for whom judge-made law was not law at all. It never had been, it never could be, and Bentham never wearied of finding new ways to say so. The contrast is striking. Austin and Dicey could not conceive of any Cookian authority in the common law to override statute. When I say Cookian, I speak, of course, of Sir Edward, but I might as well intend Sir Robin. But they had no essential quarrel with the high tradition of judicial independence, which was built into the very structure of professional legal relations, and which conferred such significant standing upon the pronouncement of rules from the superior court benches. They shared much of that Blackstonian idealization of common law, which treated it as the beauteous portion, liable to be sorely bruised by statutory intervention. Jeremy Bentham must surely rank as all-time laureate from Professor Unger's College for Mapping and Criticism. He was a man who not only got his theory of utility straight, but employed it in a lifetime of scholarship directed at reshaping virtually every institution of social existence. He is the ultimate measure, dare one say, of the quirky brilliance required of an Hungarian paragon. Of course, his longest-running project of all was to reduce the common law judge's measure of esteemed independence to a subjugate status with a pan-nomographic pyramid of codes. Rigorously committed democrat as he became, after linking with James Mill, he set out to give the populace and its representatives a constant critical oversight of all administration, including adjudication. He was under no illusion that the greatest happiness principle could provide a set of codes good for all time, any more than that judges could always know how to apply the texts particular cases. On the contrary, his restless radicalism required critical re-examination of the laws in the light of experience, both in adjudication and administration. In his unfinished, perhaps unfinishable, constitutional code, judges and executive officers, each in their tiered hierarchies of responsibility, were given a melioration suggestive function, or eventually emendative function. They were required to refer questions of difficulty back for the legislature to reformulate the norms of the relevant code. Given, moreover, that judges were to be thus within an overall democratic hierarchy, Bentham envisaged for them roles which today still cause hesitation. He would allow a pre-interpretative function, a power to give advisory opinions on matters which were not the subject of actual dispute, a power which experience in the United States Supreme Court suggests to be fundamentally unsatisfactory, and which the European Court of Justice seems to eschew, and an execution-staying or sestitive function, which would allow the judge, for some special cause, to put a stop upon the operation of the code, of which the prospective overruling occasionally admitted in American courts and by the Court of Justice form one potential example. It was in essence a plan to assemble the judiciary into a state battalion of code interpreters, justiciables, as he wanted to label them. They would, it seems, resemble the judiciaries operating the codes of modern civilian systems, with their judgments in set form, relatively abstract, and impersonal, both in relation to the people involved in the case and the identity of the adjudicators. In the event, Bentham's campaign to subordinate judges into co-operators in a ceaselessly energetic democracy has proved to be one of the least sustainable of his projects. Even the much modified position of Austin and Dicey is now on the defensive. All over a reforming world, filled with projects for liberalized economies flourishing within sustainable democracies, there are cries about judicial activism. They rise for and against in a babel of relativism. In the most porridgy democracies of East Europe, the aid of constitutional courts is sought desperately against new enactments which, as in Belarus, ban independent trade unions, or as in Slovakia, seek to impose the national language on substantial ethnic minorities. In democracies still gelatinous, the issue is also divisive. For instance, in Poland, a constitutional tribunal advisory to the legislature has been in place since 1986. It has achieved a substantial list of modifications of enactments and regulations, particularly those carried over from the former regime, concerning social security, employment, and similar matters. It is still not accessible to all, though the tribunal now considers private complaints with a view to adjudicating upon those which it deems worthy. Ultimately, its decisions remain subject to parliamentary review, operating under special voting rules. Not surprisingly, that Benthamic preference for the legislative over the judicial is currently subject to sustained criticism from advocates of a state under law. They urge that when a full constitution is finally adopted, it will turn the tribunal into a constitutional court with ultimate powers of full judicial review. But a higher constitutionalism may bring about the trial of those who perpetrated inhuman excesses during the period of martial law. The fundamental debate soon becomes immersed beneath desires and fears of particular outcomes. Consider also the hard-worn but durable democracy of Israel. The country's particular common law inheritance left it, like Australia, without a constitution which systematically entrenched fundamental freedoms such as due process. It has now acquired a set of basic statutory laws, alterable only by special majority of Knesset, one of which guarantees respect for the dignity of man. In a recent decision of prime moment, unfortunately not yet available in translation, its Supreme Court, led by its philosopher president, Judge Aaron Barak, has held that all courts must, when properly invited, adjudge the validity of ordinary legislation against the tenets of these basic laws. In the instance before the court, a 20% moratorium on certain agricultural debts, the particular legislation was held valid, so real guidance on the interpretation of the basic laws has yet to come. This evident activism is sending out seismic political tremors. It is seen by many as a vital step towards the creation of a superior set of constitutional norms, whether these are fixed in more embracing special legislation or are derived by the judges from reference to instruments of international standing, such as the European Convention on Human Rights, or are recognized as some form of common law principle. The State of Israel has long accepted a series of prohibitions of religious origin, such as the ban on the sale of pork, ethnic restrictions on marriage, and these, by their priority and date, are not subject to the present basic laws. Their supporters of the limited laws, who tend to hold the legislative balance of power, fear that the new judicial morality may lead to the outlawing of these constraints. Full judicial review is usually advocated as a protective counterbalance for minorities against the potential oppressions of majority rule. In this ironic instance, a minority privileged by history and current voting patterns sees danger in the potential views of an egalitarian court, which would permit a plurality of ideals. There can be no doubt of the drive worldwide towards high levels of judicial activism. Judges of European constitutional courts now meet regularly and doubtless gain in confidence from the exchange of precedents and ideas. In such circles, ideas of constitutional review, which draw upon American, German, or French models, are likely to have influence at the expense of the alternative positivistic ideas enshrined by Dicey in the Westminster model. Today, indeed, it is hard to explain that model to those in search of basic political stability, except as a product of an evolving democracy with a sufficiently long history for the legislature to be invested with the ultimate trust of the citizenry for the duration of an electoral term. We should not be afraid to proclaim this as a virtue ultimately to be attained. Lord Devlin certainly attested to its quintessential significance when, in his Chorley lecture here 20 years ago, he warned against a great temptation to cast the judiciary as an elite which will bypass the traffic-laden ways of the democratic process because, as he put it, that bypassing would lead inevitably, however long and winding the path, to the totalitarian state. This seems to me also to be the premise of Sir Anthony Mason's lecture in the present series. In it he records how the Australian High Court, under a constitution of British derivation, has developed a principle that legislation, while in general sovereign, cannot nevertheless prejudice the very processes of democracy, and notably that most Benthamic freedom to engage in honest criticism of public office holders, whether they be parliamentarians, public servants, or judges. The necessary implication that the Constitution cannot logically endorse measures which undermine its democratic raison d'etre was not acceptable to a minority of Sir Anthony's court, and it brought him public denunciation from his predecessor but two, Sir Garfield Barwick. To me, however, it makes a subtle but convincing case. In his lecture, Sir Anthony has compared and contrasted related but less specific techniques for abnegating, if not abrogating, statutes when they trespass upon individual freedoms. His text, to me, contains an admirable review of the range of current debate in Australasia and in this country, and that allows me to pass gratefully on to other territory. I would pause only to glance at the intricate relationship in modern systems, both common law and civilian, I think, by which law can develop to meet changing social conditions by action and reaction between case law and legislation. In discussing the influence of judges' opinions in his chapter on judicial legislation, Dicey took as his example the stepwise transformation of the rules governing the property of married women. This enabled him to demonstrate a rather satisfactory, unidirectional progress. It started from equity's interventions in favour of ladies with marriage settlements and their grand families, and ended with Parliament's eventual acceptance of complete separation of husband from wife. I suppose I should say wife from husband. By contrast, in his lecture, Lord Wedderburn has demonstrated how the control of industrial action has, in this country, become an unending joust between interveners, judges, and sometimes legislators, and abstentionists, legislators, and occasionally judges. It is, of course, because such contests persist, even in stable democracies, that the issue of ultimate authority remains as basic as it has always been. Let me then turn to the interpretation and juristic development of European law. Despite all the disagreeable growlings on the current home front, the most taxing instance of judicial activism in our own immediate legal purview probably remains the European Court of Justice. Sir Patrick Neill has recently anatomized the court's leading case law in order to demonstrate justice to the Lords Subcommittee on the forthcoming Intergovernmental Conference. What Dicey, that earlier denizen of All Souls, might have made of its case law is an intriguing question. He accepted the concept of federalism among populations which had a genuine desire to federate, and wrote perceptively about the experience of the United States and other agglomerations which had divided and delimited legislative sovereignty, while adopting varying degrees of judicial review under the framework of more or less amendable constitutions. The European community and its greater union, Dicey might, of course, have dismissed as an irrational jumble of mutually incompatible national agenda, just as he railed against the Home Rule proposals for Ireland as disguises which would not deflect a ruthless band of revolutionary separatists from their, to him, evident purpose. He might, on the other hand, have recognized the economic necessity for Britain to join in the immense producing, trading, and servicing commonality immediately adjacent to its shores. He would, in consequence, have accepted the obligation of an entrant state to cede ultimate lawmaking powers within the agreed spheres to the institutions of the Union, and he would doubtless have seen the need to empower the Court of Justice with authority to ensure observation of the law through interpretation and application of the founding treaty. With his penchant for a rule of law applicable to all through a standard, ordinary process, he would doubtless have approved many of the court's judgments as necessary to attain that uniformity. Whether in his view this would necessitate quite so abject a surrender of legislative supremacy as that required and apparently accepted in factotum, one may take leave to doubt. He would certainly have analysed carefully the case for separate guarantees secured within the structure of a member state's constitution. There can be no doubt the separate but equal power which the German Constitutional Court continues to assert over matters within its purview acts as a very considerable potential constraint on wilder imaginings in the Luxembourg court. Dicey would doubtless have accepted that provisions of community law directly applicable to individual subjects, whether in parts of the treaties or in regulations, should give them causes of action against states, public institutions, and individuals, personal or corporate, expressed to be liable. The rules of competition in the Rome Treaty and the regulations which provide for their enforcement are by common consent of this character. He might, however, have balked at those formative decisions, Verhentenlos, Costa, ERTA, which gave the same direct effect to treaty provisions which on their face only require observance by member states. Many of the rules elaborating the four basic freedoms, such as those designed to lower internal market customs tariffs in the Van Gent case, were arguably meant to be attained by national legislation alone. Pressure to secure compliance could have been confined to proceedings by the Commission or a member state to establish that non-compliance. Whether, like Sir Patrick Neill, Dicey would still struggle 30 years after the event to disaccomplish the fact might well turn upon his measure of trust in the whole venture. Does for most of us, I guess. More predictably, Dicey would have doubted the wisdom of the chase which the court has felt impelled to follow on the subject of directives, even more evidently intended for implementation at national level. Directives have nevertheless been held capable in clear cases of giving a direct right of action to intended beneficiaries against, first, a state which has failed to implement in the time set, and, equally but more surprisingly, against so-labelled organs of the state, including police authorities, health boards, local government bodies, and professional organs, such as the Paris Bar Council and the Pharmaceutical Society of Great Britain. While the state itself could be held to account for its failure to act, the other organs were in no way responsible for their state's lapse. They were implicated in the failure merely because of their verticality. When the court refused, despite a pack of baying advocates general, to impose any equivalent horizontal liability on wholly private individuals, it appeared cornered by anomaly of its own creation. The position was scarcely rectified by then imposing on the recalcitrant state a liability in damages for depriving a first private person of his or her intended right against a second, nor by the desperate injunction to national courts to interpret their own pre-existing legislation in a manner which would place it in conformity with a later, still to be implemented, directive. I could go on rattling Dicey over the court's constitutional case law, wondering whether its creative jurisprudence has been unacceptably activist, and whether indeed it always itself conforms to those high ideals of procedural fairness and individual justice which it occasionally seeks to impose on others from no firmer legal source than the constitutional traditions common to the member states. I could indeed use this vicarious device to express concern over the court's circumspection. It does, after all, often refuse to do more than throw questions of detailed application back to the national courts which refer them. This can leave disputants in a legal no man's land in which the financial ability to continue fighting may be the evident determinant of the outcome. Mr. Rawlings has recently made a scathing attack on these lines in the matter of the Sunday trading cases. At the end of the day, beyond subjecting its activities to critical review and urging upon the court the desirability of exercising appropriate restraint, but no more than that, it's hard to see what there is to be done. When the issue was put to him, Sir Patrick Neill had no benthamic proposals. The Lords subcommittee gave only passing attention to the possibility of subjecting the court's decisions to a yet higher instance composed of judges from national supreme courts or for making the decisions of the court subject to regular scrutiny with a view to legislative amendment, perhaps by Parliament and Council. But ultimate political action is already a constitutional possibility. That probably suffices. To many concerned with European Union affairs, the court has been the great and surprising success of the whole enterprise. While there will be many tensions in the course of the Intergovernmental Conference of 1996, the court is likely to receive a resounding vote of confidence. After all, there has so far been no long-standing refusal to acknowledge the supremacy of community law within its own fields. The probability is that only secondary characteristics will be examined with a view to possible betterment, minority judgments, for instance, selection of judges and their term of office, like things. The Maastricht Treaty added two new pillars alongside that constituting the economic community. The established institutions, including the court, may have no power over the arrangements made under the second and third pillars, which will be executed essentially by separate conventions. The third pillar, in particular, since it is to deal with justice and home affairs, is likely to raise important questions of due process, which ought to be referable to a final judicial instance, whether it be the Luxembourg Court or no, that can settle upon uniform interpretations of the coming law. In support of that plea, I wish to draw your attention to a cautionary tale from my own field of intellectual property law, which is much in point since it arises out of independent conventions of essentially the type which will give content to the third pillar. May I introduce the subject very simply by saying that an invention patent provides an exclusive market opportunity to exploit the invention, which is the prize, sometimes an immense prize, for a gamble. Inventions are there to be made, and research teams compete to do so. The patent reward goes to the first applicant, the other competitors being sent away with wasted research investment. The system is nonetheless an economic necessity, so it is said, for otherwise inventions and their commercial development would emerge only sluggishly or not at all. No game of chance calls for a more carefully constructed set of rules than the patent system, and these aim at clarity, maximum social return, a sense of the proportionate. A reasonable outcome is hard to achieve. And it's no surprise that patent systems have been strictly territorial creatures of the states which institute them. Nor that they differ somewhat in the set of interlocking rules which they generate. Nevertheless, for various reasons, not least that in a common market it seems natural to unify or harmonize patent laws, in West Europe, a labyrinthine collaboration on the subject was instituted in 1978 under two separate conventions. The results to date, with only half the plan executed, has in many respects been rather a success. One expression of the controversial nature of invention patents is found in rules allowing challenges to their validity to be made both during the examination stage before any grant takes place and also afterwards throughout the 20 years of their duration. As a result, in Europe, the European Patent Office has its own hierarchy of tribunals to deal with conflicts arising during the granting process. But once a grant is made, the result is, at the moment, simply a bundle of national patents for such participant states as the applicant designates. And each therefore forms its own pyramid, each state forms its own pyramid of jurisdictions over the patent, separate from that of the European Patent Office, in order to judge upon the application of the same standardized law to the same claimed invention. Well, given the inflammatory subject matter and the differences in traditional approach, Conflict between outcomes is inevitable. At present, the various European patent judges meet regularly and indeed publish their papers, not so much out of cooperation, I think, as out of desperation, is probably not too strong a word, to make common sense of a shared legislative scheme. At some points, the desire to follow a leader has led individual judges to abandon their better judgment, and they've said so. But the potential for division, which often stems from old differences in fundamental attitude, law behind the law, has proved unavoidable. Most notably, there now exists an ineradicable difference of view on the question whether a patentee should be obliged to lay out in a verbal formula the scope of protection he claims, which is the British approach, or whether there is scope for equitable judgment in the case where a competitor adopts an alternative device or process which can be characterized in some sense as an equivalent, which is the approach of continental systems as well as that of the United States. The notorious EpiLady litigation led to contrary decisions after trial in the United Kingdom and Hong Kong on the one hand, and Germany and the Netherlands on the other. A protocol interpretation designed to set a midstream course between these countercurrents has simply proved of no avail. My purpose tonight is not to debate the respective merits of this or other contests, but to draw attention to the unacceptable consequences of multiplying distinct jurisdictions with authority over essentially the same legal issue. Pluralism may have virtues in some legal contexts, but this is not one of them. Of course, the whole sorry structure came into being through a political process which is as complex as the very evolution of the common market itself. And it may be that already it contains its own mechanisms for eventually resolving the difficulty. At the same time, the problem came about, and could as easily come about in third pillar matters, because structures of adjudication tend to be late agenda items in the tackling of new problems, whether at national or community level. Lawyers have a special duty to point up the consequences of ignoring or fudging them. Finally, let me turn to some remarks on international institutions and their effect on private rights. So I am at this juncture turning away from judiciaries which operate within state or federated constitutions to that world of international legal principle where the concordat of states replaces the enactments of legislative bodies or government councils, and a jus cogens accretes from the practices of states. John Austin, you will remember, dismissed the claim of such norms to the quality of law, placing them beside rules of honor and rules of fashion, the learned Grotius alongside the Iron Duke and Beau Brummel. Judge Higgins, in her lecture, traced the development of international law as a scholarly discipline, especially within this school, and welcomed its reception by today's post-positivist judiciary. However, while this is occurring, we may also notice an important initiative to supply international treaties with those very sanctions essential to the canons of command by which Austin identified law. The General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade, the GATT, has from its outset adopted a procedure for dispute settlement between its participant states, which can, by way of enforcement, involve so-called cross-retaliation, putting it crudely, let in our fish or we will keep out your semiconductor chips. Now, at the insistence of the world's industrial leaders, as they shore up their high-cost labor economies by selling their relatively advanced ideas, there are new agreements within the GATT on services and intellectual property in particular, which stem from the Uruguay round completed in April 1994. It is this last agreement, the TRIPS agreement, trade-related intellectual property, which concerns me for the novel degree to which it imposes measures of harmonisation of national laws upon its 120-odd member states. Countries belonging to the GATT's new World Trade Organization are obliged to adopt intellectual property laws of a far higher level of specificity than was ever attained under the older toothless conventions which have been amassing since the 1880s, the Paris Convention on Patents, Designs, Trademarks and Unfair Competition, the Berne, UCC and Rome Conventions on Copyright. Equally, TRIPS obliges the WTO states to introduce enforcement mechanisms such as injunctions, seizure, compensation, and even in some cases criminal penalties. And these must be expeditious, fair, and equitable, not unnecessarily complex or costly or entailing unreasonable time limits or unwarranted delays, which makes it amusing to speculate upon how the United States, so vociferous a TRIPS proponent, will itself be measured against such criteria. TRIPS has set up for the aggressive world of intellectual property claimants a second chance at litigation. Imagine, for instance, a dispute over whether a copyright computer program can be the subject of reverse engineering by decompilation in order to produce a compatible, non-infringing program. This will first be litigated through the instances of the country where infringement is alleged. If it's an EEC country, there will doubtless be a cassational side trip to the Luxembourg court in order to determine the meaning of the ludicrously complicated directive on the subject. If it all goes against the plaintiff, that claimant may cause its government to institute proceedings against the refusing state, claiming that under TRIPS, no exception is permissible because the reverse engineering prejudices the interests of the right owner. If the outcome is in favour of the plaintiff's state, it may in its turn insist upon the withdrawal of trade concessions under the GATT, which will hurt enough to induce a change in the copyright law. Indeed, after 5 years, it will be possible to raise such a dispute on the basis of prejudicial conduct which escapes violating the actual terms of the TRIPS, a so-called non-violation breach. I have even seen it suggested that if a country such as France chooses to impose a quota on the television showing of foreign films, inevitably in this context American, the copyright owners of the latter will be able to argue from TRIPS that an embargo is impermissible. Forget the fact that copyright itself is a negative right designed to prevent others from using pirated or unlicensed copies for sales or performances. It's not concerned with the copyright owner's or licensee's exploitation of its own material. Forget the fact that negotiations on quotas in the audiovisual sector broke down and nothing was included in the new GATT on the provision of material for broadcasting. It would be enough under this argument that some essential spirit of TRIPS had been dishonoured. Whether such a claim would ever finally be sustained in a WTO dispute settlement claim is wholly speculative. It is the possibility that it can even be contemplated which should be a cause of considerable concern in the new world of trade collaboration. For those collaborations are now vital enough to many states to open new temptations to the powerful nations, demand prices of many sorts for their opening of markets, as much as for more direct aid. What we are contemplating is the threat of international litigation as a means of procuring private rights for individual foreigners, where direct negotiation to procure them has failed, either plainly or doubtfully. A particular point to be made in today's context is that the dispute will be settled by a tribunal of three, of suitably balanced composition. In the early years, they are likely to be drawn from those government negotiators who generated the TRIPS in midnight enclaves, people steeped in the esoteric power politics of that process, rather than philosophers of the role and purpose of the rights. Point for this evening is that dispute settlement panels will work at a total remove from the political institutions of the state under attack. The settlement could well adopt an activist approach to the interpretation of the TRIPS text. It could perhaps rely on some common heritage of international customary law in intellectual property matters, for which certain high-thinking groups are even now seeking recognition. Whatever the outcome, a settlement will have immense influence. It will establish the essential content of the laws on the subject in well-nigh all states. Of course, some short-circuiting of the long-enduring process would be achieved within the EC if parts of the TRIPS were held to be directly effective as a matter of community law. That potentiality, which opens a palm full of legal niceties, seems not unnatural to some of our EC partners. In varying degrees, they are already prepared to recognise the direct enforceability of provisions, such as those of the Paris Convention on Industrial Property, Berne Convention on Copyright. The Court of Justice, moreover, has shown itself willing to accept the direct application of an international agreement negotiated within the community's external affairs competence. The prospect of applying the same technique to the rather general prescriptions of an agreement such as the TRIPS seems to me fraught with difficulty. In this country, as in Scandinavia, we maintain a positivist balance, a positivist severance, I should say, between treaty obligation and municipal law, which strives precisely to preserve the intervening role of national legislatures. Of course, it's a less than perfect position, but looking at the matter comparatively, we do have a deserved reputation for implementing our international obligations, and we seek to do so in ways which fit within our internal legal structures. We thereby reduce the pressures on our judiciary to construct national law out of treaty formulations, formulations which may be ambiguous just because they reflect the contradictory expectations of the negotiating states. One point at which the Luxembourg Court should undoubtedly be discouraged from activism is over the direct enforcement of international obligations in such a context. There is real virtue in requiring that those obligations pass into community law only after the lawmaking institutions of the community itself have settled in detail how this should occur, and in particular, how far implementation should devolve to national lawmakers in the member states. The community position is, in the end, but a consequential aspect of this and other developing international legal orders. The root issue to be faced is whether we are at all wise to put the settlement of world trade law, let alone, say, world policing or world drug control, in the hands of remote arbitral tribunals whose conclusions can be challenged only by labyrinthine political processes in which the strong alone are likely to keep striving. The choice is, in one sense, more extreme than that over the adoption of the European Convention of Human Rights. For there, the question is whether the convention should, in some entrenched or unentrenched form, become part of municipal law to be interpreted by judges who can know the competing claims within our society and in some reasonably attached way calculate the consequences of their decisions. The World Trade Organization and its jurisdiction is with us. It will need most careful monitoring for its own sake and as a precedent. An international legal order of its essential type could be the true novelty of the coming century, the legal eventuality which Dicey a century ago would have found least predictable. For the participant states, it will present conundrums in securing the acceptance of distant decision-making within their polities. A major concern must therefore be to secure people of outstanding ability, knowledge, and experience to act as arbitrators in such a settlement process. Above all, as Professor Teubner's lecture urges, they must be capable of listening to and judging between arguments posed within varying frames of reference. They must be neither narrow calculators of rational efficiency nor weary pragmatists of international negotiation. It will be obvious that legal education has before it greater challenges than ever as it strives to fit each generation for such tasks. This school will undoubtedly play an important role in showing how the answers should be provided. For, as many of the lectures in this series show, it has done so in the past with verve and effect. When the school turns 125, there will doubtless be a new series of lectures on equivalent themes. Whatever their precise thrusts, the process of judging and its relationship to other centres of power within states and in wider world communities will remain central considerations. With luck, this country will be able to hold to its essentially Dicean line on the relation of adjudication to legislation. At the same time, there are other important issues affecting the process by which courts interpret and generate law. In the coming years, they are quite likely to concern increasing webs and other complications of jurisdiction. These will all too easily provide ways by which the determined and powerful can keep re-arguing their case. It's been my first purpose this evening to draw attention to these prospects and to call for vigilance over them.
Professor Cornish will probably forgive me, even if Professor Dicey wouldn't, if I give the last word on the relationship between judges and legislation to a Frenchman. Writing about codification of French administrative law, a previous vice president of the Conseil d'Etat said that he could not anticipate such a development coming about. The judges of the Conseil d'Etat would prevent it, it would render their work too dull. I feel that we might agree with that. On that note, I would like to thank Professor Cornish for a contribution to our series, which landed us, as I think such a set of lectures should, squarely in the work of the next century. And on that note, I would like to invite everybody to join us in the senior common room, where I fear that we may encounter what I've written down as being a semiconducted chip. Thank you very much indeed, Professor Cornish.